John Allen presents the Creepy Crawl Podcast.
Oh, hello there.
Welcome back, creeps, to your show of shows, the Creepy Crawl Podcast. How are you today? I am your king of bling, your leader of cedar. Yes, cedar is a tree, and I will be your tree of knowledge. I am John Allen, alongside my, imaginary co-host Woodrow. How are you? That's kind of a question I know the answer to, because you are beautiful and sexy, I imagine, because only people of such stature listen to this podcast. Speaking of this podcast, it's a ghostly ghosty today, so that gnarly, pretend, fake, imaginary intro music you cannot hear because I don't have the money to afford the rights is the song Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell. Thanks, as always, to my people, my beautiful MFers, my straws that stir the drink to keep the show alive, the patrons, and those who send money directly to the show via Venmo. If you would like to see your sex appeal raise like 10 points, you can join these people by simply going to patreon.com/creepycrawl. For a direct hit like the game Battleship, you can go to Venmo at jonathan-allen-154. And creeps, I implore you, follow me on Twitter. That is the handle would be, of course, at writerjohnallen, no H, boy band style, because on there you'll have access to the insanity that is the psyche of my mind, as well as a bunch of puns, but most importantly, episode drops and photos that kind of tie these stories together. Also, you know what, creeps? I have a mission for you. If you happen to have a ghostly ghosty, or a tinfoil conspiracy, or just a gnarly true crime that you would like for me to, I don't know, give it the rub, put my touch on, put my scent on, why don't you hit me up on that Twitter and we'll make it happen. Now, research for today's episode occurred on April 13th, and on this day in history in 1963, my fellow Cincinnati native Pete Rose hit a triple, very impressive, for his first Major League Baseball hit. I have a Pete Rose story. I actually met him many times over the years living in Cincinnati. I eventually worked for a restaurant called Willie's Sports Bar and Grill. This actually happened before then, but Willie's Sports Bar and Grill was run by Bill Cunningham. Bill Cunningham went on to be a Fox News right-wing radio talk show host on one of the, if not the biggest radio stations on AM radio. I didn't know all that at the time, of course. He would later host a show called The Bill Cunningham Show, which was a trash talk daytime TV show. I think they just said, you know what, Jerry Springer's from Cincinnati, let's see if we can continue the magic. It did not end up magical, but regardless, Bill Cunningham, big deal in Cincinnati, and knew all the sports stars, right? So when you walk into Willie's, you see, you know, kind of like Hollywood, you see like the famous Cincinnati athletes with their handprints on the ground, that sort of thing. So the year's 1990, and Pete Rose is definitely a regular at Willie's because coming off a year after his lifetime ban from baseball, he's just adored in the city, and he gets his adulation at Willie's. So my family, it is myself, my father, my mother, and my younger sister. The youngest had not been born yet. My younger sister, I think, was 6 or 7, and she had the coolest technology of the time, which would have been a disposable camera. So we're walking into Willie's, and wouldn't you know it, out comes Peter Edward Rose with his bowl cut and all. Of course, I ask Pete for an autograph. He obliges. And then he notices my sister with a camera. My parents are imploring her to take a photo of Pete Rose. Kind of a common thing, right? So Pete kind of starts to pose. And my sister says, no, I am not wasting a photo. Of course, she had no idea who the fuck Pete Rose was, but she would rather take photos of clouds that she thought looked like meatloaf or something. So I thought that was a funny story. Pete Rose, just months after being banned from baseball, was banned by a 6-year-old girl from having his photo taken, and sullenly he walked away. But enough about me. Today we discuss the Chelsea Hotel, which is the second most haunted place in the very haunted New York City. Not dissimilar to the Dakota Building, which we covered in my atrocious debut episode. The second most haunted motel and perhaps the most haunted city in the world. So, safe to say, it's spooky. Now, with that, creeps, I invite you to sprinkle some sage and keep those Ghostbusters on speed dial and creepy crawl with me. We all have our origin stories, and the Chelsea does as well. So, the Chelsea Hotel, which is currently closed for renovations, although I think they're doing something with it currently, sits at 222 West 23rd Street between 7th and 8th Avenues. It is a beautiful red brick building, built with a mixture of like Victorian Gothic and Queen Anne style. There are wrought iron balconies and a grand stairwell located in the middle of the hotel. It's kind of like the Titanic, but on land, you know, and not, I was going to say not the site of a massacre, but wait, it was. The Chelsea Hotel is a national and state landmark building, and as mentioned in the opening of the show, it is the second most haunted place in the most haunted city of New York City. Just in case you're wondering, the first most haunted place would be the New York Public Library on 42nd Street, and we'll definitely get into that. But if you've ever seen the original Ghostbusters, you might remember, I think it was amongst the opening scenes where they're chasing ghosts at the library. And that was the library, that was the whole deal, based on how truly haunted it is in real life. The Chelsea was initially intended to be this socialist utopian commune, very much like the Dakota. The old-timey architect with the, I'm just assuming here, classic curled mustache, his name was Philip Hubert, and he was raised in a family devoted, oddly, what a weird devotion, to the ideas of French philosopher Charles Fourier. Charles Fourier proposed that the construction of, well, he proposed for the construction of self-contained settlements that would meet every possible need of its inhabitants, professional and personal. Basically, he was into like mini bitty cities that existed as apartment complexes. After the stock market crash of 1873, Hubert and his curled mustache, which I'm assuming, and as well as his monocle, which I'm assuming, decided that New York was ready for its own Charles Fourierian, I guess, commune, and devised a plan to build co-op apartments in New York City. Residents would save money by sharing fuel and services and resources. Hubert's creations became New York City's first co-ops and were ceremoniously successful, as well as becoming the crown jewel that would be the Chelsea. The Chelsea opened in 1884, because everything that's haunted is from the 1800s. True to the Frenchman Fourier's philosophy, Hubert reserved apartments for the people who built the building, like labormen, you know, like electricians, construction workers, interior designers, plumbers. He then interspersed and surrounded these laborers with artists of all genres, like writers, musicians, actors, whatever, painters. So, kind of a neat little, again, utopian society. It's actually a cool idea, don't you think, Woodrow? Woodrow thinks so, too. I'd be down to clown with that shiz. The top floor was reserved for 15 artist studios. This building is sounding more and more like heaven to me. Hudson River School paintings hung in the shared dining rooms, and the hallways and ceilings were decorated with natural motifs. At a whopping 12 stories, the Chelsea was the tallest building in New York. Of course, remember, it's 1884. But Hubert's grandiose vision went bankrupt in 1905, and the Chelsea was converted into a luxury hotel. This proved to be a very popular hotel. It was visited regularly by guests like Mark Twain, William Dean Howells, and the painter John Sloane. All of you have heard of Mark Twain. Maybe if you're really into art, you've heard of the others, but it'd be like these days, like the Kardashians living there and Beyonce or some bullshit like that. After World War II, as the hotel declined and room prices fell, again, very similar to the Cecil Hotel and other such concepts, the hotel attracted painters like Jackson Pollock. It attracted James T. Farrell, Virgil Thompson, Larry Rivers, Kenneth Tynan, James Schuyler, and the poet Dylan Thomas, whose death in 1953 further enhanced the hotel's legend. Quote, "I've had 18 straight whiskeys," said Dylan Thomas, after polishing off a bottle of old granddad on the last day of his life. "I think that's the record." Well, what do they say, creeps? Play stupid games, win stupid prizes? Arthur C. Clarke wrote 2001, A Space Odyssey at the Chelsea. William Burroughs wrote The Third Mind. And Jack Kerouac had a one-night stand with Gore Vidal at the Chelsea. In 1966, Andy Warhol shot parts of his masterpiece, the film Chelsea Girls, of course, at the Chelsea. The Chelsea Hotel became a cauldron of creativity, and it was a place that every artist globally knew about and aimed for. They put their little bullseye on a map and said, that's where I want to be, no, nay, need to be. The Chelsea Hotel guest list of residential bohemians included, but was not limited to, Patti Smyth, actress Sarah Bernhardt, political radical Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Thomas Wolfe, and Bob Dylan, amongst many. Oh, and ghosts. Lots and lots of ghosts. And then there's the rooms. So many famous people. Again, if you don't recognize the names I mentioned, let me tell you, I'm big time in here. They were big time. And the rooms at the Chelsea are famous as well. So, let's, I don't know, creeps, run through some. So, follow me. Come on. Don't be shy. So, let's start from the bottom up. Room 100. This might be one that you all might know or have heard of. Punk icons Sid Vicious and girlfriend Nancy Spungend lived here in room 100 at the Chelsea. Again, if you know these names, you know where I'm going. Nancy was found dead in the suite's bathroom on October 12th of 1978. Sid, of course, was charged with her murder and released on bail, whereupon he died of a heroin overdose at the home of a new girlfriend in 1979. Well, what a douche for having a new girlfriend so soon. What a douche for killing his past girlfriend. Also, how about no bail for murderers? I don't know. Crazy idea. Several guests have had run-ins with the ghost of Sid and Nancy, as well as hearing loud arguments. Lard arguments. Yeah, Sid and Nancy were arguing about a form of fat. That is the scariest story at the Chelsea. They were arguing about lard. Oh my god, you should hear their spam talks. It's like the food, not the mail thing. that's a good thing I don't edit. What I was saying, the ghost of Sid and Nancy, people hear loud arguments between them while staying in the room. So I guess bickering post-mortem is punk. Punk as fuck. Who knew? And then we move on to Room 105. Actress Edie Sedgwick, who died young, was moved here because she had set her previous room at the Chelsea on fire. Lots of leeway back then. Apparently she was a pyro. You'd think she would have been kicked out, but they just moved rooms. They moved her room, or to Room 105, because the room was above the lobby, and staff wanted to keep a close eye on her because they were boo-boo-faced about the fire incident. Well, no kidding. We come to Room 114. In 2009, a hotel guest named Anna had a paranormal experience on the last night of a three-night stay at the Chelsea. While in bed, she began to feel afraid. Then she heard a loud door slam, followed by disembodied running for several minutes. Then she also heard footsteps around her, inside the room, like right next to her. Then, to tie a bow on Anna's theater of death, a severed head in dramatic makeup hovered in front of the bedroom mirror. Anna said it appeared to be the face of the writer and poet Dylan Thomas. This, I think, creeps is when you invoke the ABC rule. A, B, see you later. We get to Room 120. I don't like this one too much, but in 2008, hotel guest Steve Clark stayed in this room. And Steve Clark was a, quote, sensitive to spirit energy. Steve Clark stayed in Room 120 for a grand total of 10 minutes before requesting a new one. He said that there was, quote, a sad energy in the back by the bathroom. I couldn't breathe well. Clark said the spirit was lost and looking for help, unable to leave the hotel. Clark was unable to help, of course. Being in Room 120, I don't know, he should have sent the spirit to Room 121 and been like, yeah, those people will help you. And then just like turn off the lights and pretended he wasn't home. That's what I would have done. Ghost. They're so easily fooled. Then we get to Room 124. A plethora of visitors to this particular suite reported to Chelsea Hotel Blog, which is a online place where people discuss hauntings and ghostly affairs of the Chelsea. They reported to the blog that they heard a female voice screaming, a ghostly image in the bathroom, and the blurry ghost of an old man. Again, creeps, this is all in Room 124. One of these reports included a photo they had taken in their room. It appears to show a skeleton standing behind a doorframe that they did not notice until they got home and looked at the picture. In real time, they did not notice it at all. As usual, I will post it on the Tweety Bird. Let's move to Room 205. Here we have writer and poet Dylan Thomas. Dylan Thomas moved into the Chelsea into Room 205 on October 20th of 1953. Thomas was that previously mentioned Rhodes Scholar who downed a bottle of whiskey to turbocharge his life expectancy. He was already in poor health and spent his final somewhat lucid days at the hotel. So he dies there on November 9th of 1953. Over the years, many guests at the hotel have claimed to have encountered Dylan Thomas's ghost, as well as hear aggressive footsteps in the room upon which he stayed in. Now we get to room 211. Okay, this is kind of creepy to me. If you listen to the John Lennon / number 9 episode with, you know, the numerology episode, you'll recall my experiences with 1111 and 211 being not only a link to that, but also being my childhood address as well. So, of course, there's a 211 on the list. Singer-songwriter Bob Dylan stayed in this room during the 60s, where he wrote the song Sarah and Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. Nothing died in 211 but vocal ability. Bob Dylan is an iconic songwriter, but his voice sounds like a frog with strep throat. Then we go to room 323. A character by the name of Club Kid Christina lived at the hotel in the 80s. She died in her room in June of 89. She was dead for like 5 days before her body was discovered. She is often seen in this room, dressed up in full-on late 1980s Club Kid regalia, which is scarier than most anything, including a missed call from the IRS. And if you're listening, IRS, I'm claiming COVID disabilities, and I can't pay you this year. Sorry. Room 415. Ah, yes. My fave. This was Janis Joplin's room at the Chelsea, and this is where she had her infamous tryst with Leonard Cohen. So creeps, we're adults here. The two met in an elevator, and the 20-something Janis Joplin thought it would be funny to, what's the best way to put it, fillet the iconic but very old famous composer Leonard Cohen. So, yes, as a gag, she performed oral sex on an old man. Moving on to room 424, that is where Leonard Cohen himself lived during the 60s, and probably bragged to his friends that Janis Joplin blew him. Room 442. Andy Warhol brought Edie Sedgwick here in 1965 to film that short, The Chelsea Girls. She would die young, and another Warhol disciple, Valerie Solano, lived at the Chelsea before later shooting Andy Warhol and almost killing him. So there's a lot of spookery there if you're a Warhol fan, which I am, because that dude was weird as fuck, and I'm here for it. Excuse me, I have to take a sip of water. Okay. Room 515. John Bon Jovi wrote the song and filmed the video for Midnight at the Chelsea here. Bon Jovi, nothing really happened in 515. But Bon Jovi singing anything past 1988, to me, is fucking frightening. Room 614. What up, Columbus, Ohio? Shout out to my old area code, 614. Go Buckeyes. This is where playwright Arthur Miller lived, alongside his daughter, Rebecca Miller, who is the wife of Daniel Day-Lewis. And Arthur Miller lived here several years after his divorce from Marilyn Monroe. I'm not saying there might be a curse, but have you listened to my Marilyn episode? I'm telling you, creeps, it's weird. These things dawn on me as I go, as I read them. But it seems like all these episodes, like, just relate to one another. There's a lot of synchronicity going on.
Oh, yes, room 822. This is where Madonna took photographs for her thirsty and infamous 1992 book, Sex. No ghost again, just my eyes are forever haunted. Then there's room 829. Writer Thomas Wolfe spent the last few years of his life at the Chelsea. He died in 1938, and his ghost is often seen at the joint. Room 915. It's 2009, and hotel guest Steve Clark, remember Mr. Sensitive from earlier? Well, he's back, and he claims he was awakened at 4 a.m. and handed a glow-in-the-dark frisbee by a, quote, energy. So again, he's that sensitive from room 120 earlier. He said he was not frightened by the energy and was able to get back to sleep. I say he's like Charlie, the dog of the two married men I live with and rent from. Attention seeking. I don't know about Steve Clark, and at least Charlie's a good boy. Lastly, we have room 1017. Singer-songwriter Patti Smyth lived here with photographer Robert Mapplethorpe in 1969. This is where Mapplethorpe took his first photographs. Mapplethorpe was sort of a pariah slash icon slash weird guy. He's been seen, as well as his, well, I should say his ghostly figure has, at least, snapping photos at the Chelsea. Many years after his 1989 death from AIDS complications. So that's a brief history of a lot of rooms in the Chelsea. But these spooks are somewhat new school. What do you say, Woodrow? You want to kick it old school? Let's kick it old school. Yeah, be sure to check out the Twitter so I can show you some pictures of this hotel. Kind of show you that it is spooky as fuck. I can't wait, creeps. At the end of this recording, I'm going to watch Wonder Woman 1984. I love it, love it, love it. Okay. It is known, guys, creeps, that the Chelsea Hotel housed survivors from that 1912 sinking of the Titanic. Kind of makes sense. Like I said earlier, the Chelsea was sort of, I guess, decorative-wise, like the Titanic. So, survivors of the Titanic were kind of sent off to the Chelsea to live for the most part. Jack could have been one of them if Rose would have scooted her dumbass over on the raft. Anyway, Mary was one of the survivors of the Titanic. These are facts, by the way. She lost her husband, of course, when he sank alongside the Titanic. Sopranos actor Michael Imperioli remains shook to this day about this ghastly encounter he had with Mary. So, as legend goes, Mary became distraught, depressed, and was never really able to adjust to life after the Titanic. I mean, who could? It's just, what a clusterfuck, right? She hung herself in her room on the fifth floor. Mary is most often seen on the west end of the building where the archway is in that hallway, where the original large apartment's entryway would have been. So this is where Mary hung herself. Mary is seen often checking herself in the mirror. Henceforth, she is referred to as the Vain Ghost. So, essentially, a Kardashian ghost. Ah, the Kardashian Car-Crashian.
What nonsense that family is, huh?
One thing of note, Mary does not like to be bothered by the living. So, if you find yourself at the Chelsea, and you do see her, probably don't expect any welcoming words or gestures. Don't expect Christmas cards or invites to barbecue, anything like that. Mary looks upon the living as an annoyance, which kind of like me. So it's little wonder that she gave Michael Imperioli, the Sopranos actor, a very obvious sign that he was not wanted in her ghostly space. Quote, At the end of the hallway was a figure of a woman in the corner, kind of hunched over. Her head was down. She was crying, he said. I called out and said, "Are you okay?" Right after I said that, from behind me, I heard a loud pop. I turned around immediately. The light bulb in the fixture had popped, so that part of the hallway had become very dark. And when I turned back around, she was completely gone. He moved out within a week. A week? Are you fucking kidding me? My Uber would have been ordered the second that light bulb imploded. That is Blumhouse horror movie shit. Then there is Nadia, the severed hand ghost. 10 years after Mary hung herself, in 1922, the New York Times reported that a young woman... It's kind of cool, creeps. You can, if you're into microfiche film like I am, you can look at all these old newspaper headlines and stuff. So this is one of them. But they reported that a young woman in her 20s had swan-dived out of the window facing 23rd Street and shook hands with death on that sidewalk. Before her fatal plunge, Nadia had placed her right hand in the middle of a pair of huge industrial scissors normally used to cut bolts of cloth, closed the scissors, and cut off her right hand. The pain was more than she expected, which, if you're cutting off your hand, how do you not expect that pain? But since this pain was beyond what she expected, she threw herself out of the window. I guess a lot of people, you know, like if you're on fire, you would throw yourself out of a window to end it, or maybe shoot yourself. I don't know. So that was the kind of pain that Nadia was in. What a fucked up story. Battier than Bruce Wayne's petting zoo. So her backstory, Nadia had grown up at the Chelsea and was the spoiled daughter of a wealthy silk merchant. And the family lived in like a posh suite of rooms. Nadia, of course, was an artist because she was a rich kid, so she had that freedom to be an artist. But her plans to pursue said artistic vision was cut short when she was met, well, when she met a dashing songwriter and eloped while the two were still in their teens. So if you fast forward a few years later, Prince Charming falls into alcoholism, and this bohemian artist finds herself stuck with two young children and a husband to babysit. With nothing left, Nadia returns to the Chelsea. She begs Daddy to let her kids and her hubby return to the Chelsea because they had nowhere else to go and her husband was trash. Nadia's father was a dick. He was still saltier than a pretzel over the fact that Nadia had left to marry a drunk songwriter and then proceeded to have two kids without any means of supporting them. But he relented like a dick would. He let Nadia and the family return to the Chelsea Hotel under one condition. Nadia was responsible for all of the housework and cleaning, as well as bringing in piecework sewing to add to the household income. And this is terrible. Also, Nadia had to hand wash her mother's underthings. This was, I guess you would say, a constant activity. It was a constant activity because Nadia's mother was incontinent. Man, Woodrow, rich people are weirder than ecstasy kids at Burning Man. So yes, as part of her punishment, this married mother of two had to wash her mother's shat-upon drawers. Well, it became too much, as you can imagine, and doing art was impossible. Her hands were becoming ruined from the never-ending housework. So, logic intact, obviously, Nadia cuts off her right hand and left her tragic existence through a window. So this happened, creeps, on a moonless night, and it is on moonless nights that Nadia can be seen wisping outside the windows of the upper floors of the Chelsea Hotel. floating about like a freaky fucking specter whom you should close the curtains on. Her long hair and flowing white gown just wave in the wind. She wants to come back to the Chelsea Hotel, but she cannot find her way back inside. I'm not opening the damn window for Nadia. Thank you, fuck you, bye.
Well, creeps, it's time for the Woodrow Comedy Minute that lasts longer than a minute. We really need to rename this segment. Woodrow, let me tell you, creeps, Woodrow normally is afraid of ghosts, but he has been sipping White Claw all day, so he's feeling ballsy, and he is also constantly telling me how much he loves me. It's pretty fucking annoying, if I'm honest. But, hence, today's jokes are going to be about ghosts. Are you sure, Woodsy? No, don't call me a pussy. I don't want you conjuring up any malcontented haints. Okay, tough guy. No, I'm not scared. I'm just saying you make bad decisions. If this ends up, folks, if this ends up like that time that Woody and I took a time machine back to 1982 and bet our life savings that Mr. T would beat Rocky in the final match in Rocky 3, I'm not going to speak to Woodrow for like a week probably, so yeah. Alright, this is your best work, your best drunken work. Okay, well here we go. Okay, creeps, joke one from Woodrow. Are you ready for these jokes about ghosts? The joke is, how do ghosts like their eggs cooked? Terra fried. Okay, seriously, dude, are you in some kind of a soma coma? You couldn't conjure up a root beer burp with that weak sauce. Okay, well, a joke too, I guess, about ghosts here. I mean, terrified? What the fuck? Okay, joke two. Why can't ghosts get drunk in a dry county? Because they don't serve spirits. Woodsy, nobody has called booze spirits since like 1974. No one is going to get that joke. Okay, well, jokes, as you know, creeps, are always funnier when you have to explain them. So, yeah. Older people will call alcohol spirits, and yeah, that was that joke, I guess. Whew, boy, this is not going well for Woodrow. Final Woodrow joke, my beautiful people. What do you call a ghost chicken? Oh boy. A poultrygeist. Okay, well, much like Nadia's hand, Woodrow is cut off. Please give me the White Claw there, sir. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. Not the most terrifying jokes, or I'm sorry, terrifying jokes. But anyway, creeps, that's our Woodrow. Now back to the show.
This is a good one here. So a more recent ghost to the Chelsea Hotel crew is Larry the Hipster Ghost. It was bound to happen, creeps. Hipsters and other annoying types will one day haunt the world with oozing frights and smug pretentiousness. I mean, just think about it. One day we're going to be haunted by, I don't know, the kind of guys who did that insurrection back at the start of the year. You're going to have that. You're going to have the hipsters. You're going to have just all kinds of people. So one can imagine what those hauntings are going to be like. Will it even be scary? I mean, how do you get rid of a hipster ghost? Do you show them the latest iPhone? But according to verified reports from a medium who relayed her findings in that Chelsea Hotel blog, Larry the Hipster Ghost is unique because, well, he never stops talking. damned hipster. Probably wearing a bowler cap and talking about vinyl records just nonstop. Larry is so anxious to tell his story that, much to the annoyance of his fellow ghost, Larry will push himself to the front of every ghostly gathering at the Chelsea Hotel to spread his wisdom. Oh my God, so people like that in real life are now doing that in death. This is a nightmare. So, when spirits are aware that a living person can hear and or see them, it is then that the ghosts become storytellers. Larry the hipster ghost never gives any other ghost a chance to share their story. But apparently, Larry the hipster ghost has an important message to relay. According to Larry the hipster ghost, everything inside the Chelsea Hotel is real. But once you walk outside the hotel doors, you enter into an illusion. So I gather that Larry loved The Matrix in real life, I guess. The movie The Matrix? I don't know. Larry the hipster ghost tells us that there is something underground at the hotel from long, long before the Chelsea was built. Some preternatural power that fuels the Chelsea Hotel's creativeness. As for his message, he says how one conducts themselves at the Chelsea Hotel is what is important, not just the art, but how someone lives their life while living at the Chelsea Hotel. So by that notion, Sid of Sid and Nancy is fucked, and rightfully so, with his trash music and his beating women and killing them. Ugh. Countless guests of the Hotel Chelsea, or the Chelsea Hotel, there's two ways to say that, y'all, report strange sightings at the legendary Manhattan establishment, well, they did at least before it closed, writing into that aforementioned blog with reports of literal skeletons in the closet. Again, check my Twitter. Piercing screams, disembodied footsteps, and again, the dead face of the dead writer, Dead Dylan Thomas. The hotel has been besieged by rumors of ghosts and lost souls wandering its hallways since forever. Here's a few fun ones. In a more modern recent report, a woman, her sister, and their mother reported problems with the lights, writing, quote, "The lights in our bathroom and hallway went off and over while we were there." They added that they heard a high-pitched female scream, as well as a mischievous sink that kept turning on and off, with weird bubbles rising up from the drain. Doesn't that give you Elisa Lam vibes? Brr. Fuck that. And then there's the picture. Remember that skeleton in the closet? Again, my Twitter. After taking a seemingly normal picture of a closet in the room, there appeared later to be a skeleton peeking out from behind the doorframe. It was not there in real life, the women wrote, but there it was on celluloid when they got home. Quote, "The ones I thought had interesting stories were the good folks working behind the front desk," wrote multimedia digital artist Brian Bothwell, a longtime Chelsea Hotel resident. "They always had to address the ghost problem and move overnight guests from one room to the next. There was always a guest calling the front desk wanting to change rooms due to something they saw or something they felt." Creepy. A night security guard named Timor, that's kind of a cool name. Oh, I wonder what nationality that is. Sounds Latino. I like that. Timor told resident of the Chelsea and musician Timothy Sullivan that an old, not old timey, but
I guess, a call girl, a dead call girl named Victoria, who liked to dress up like that cartoon Betty Boop, you know, with the big eyes and the hair and all that stuff, had actually died of AIDS, unfortunately, while living at the hotel. So, some time later, the new tenant of the room called Timor, asking that her room be changed. Why, creeps, you ask? Because she looked in the mirror and saw the image of Victoria staring back at her, Betty Boop bangs and all. The respected novelist Sparkle Hater, cool name, has her own story to tell, and it's nonfiction. Hater wrote on the blog that she once rented a third-floor room that had previously been occupied by a drug dealer who was into, drumroll please, bestiality porn, and was wanted by the police for imprisoning a woman there. The couple who moved in after this dastardly freak show were known for their domestic violence, sort of like Sid and Nancy. When Sparkle Hater, the author, was away on book tours and her apartment was left empty, her neighbors heard incessant typing inside as if the writer were somehow inside of the room, just going crazy on a typewriter. And that's not all. Quote, I often saw the shadow of a crouched woman in a corner of my room late at night and heard weeping. When I walked towards it, she disappeared. Well, that sounds a lot like me, or like Mary to me. Remember Michael Imperioli? The vain ghost. She likes to do that thing. She draws you in. She cries. You go to help, and what do you get for your help? Spook the fuck out. Next, we have artist Jennifer Elise Chaparral. And Jennifer reported, quote, there was definitely something going on the 10th floor. I could feel the energy. I've had some moments where my hair just stood up and I knew I had to run and get off that floor. One time around 1997, my roommate saw the ghost of a man standing in our kitchen in the middle of the night around 2 in the morning. It was crazy. It scared me. 2 in the morning, close to the witching hour. Not quite there, but, you know. Lindsay Noble, an abstract painter who is one of the talking heads in the film Chelsea on the Rocks, lived in room 507 from 2003 until 2005. She had been living there a short time when she was visited by the ghost of the writer and author William S. Burroughs. Quote, he was floating above me. When I breathed in, he breathed in. Then I introduced myself. I said, hi, I'm Lindsay. I'm an artist. I'm going to be living here, and could you please keep the other ghost out of my room? After that, there were no more ghosts. You know, that's kind of sweet and very smart on her part. And that's the thing about writers. William Burroughs was a writer. I'm a writer. Always trust us writers and support our podcast. You know, if William S. Burroughs had a podcast right now, you'd support that. So keep supporting mine. Go give me 5 stars somewhere. I'll never check it because I don't read reviews because everybody's a Karen these days and wants to be boo-boo face and cry and this person cusses and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, whatever. Elisa Bocanegra is the producing artistic director of LA's Hero Theater Company and was at the Chelsea. Quote, I was staying there when Hurricane Sandy hit in 2012. No lights, no electricity. It felt like a haunted house. Since I'm a glutton for punishment, I decided to take the stairwell and walk to the apartment where Sid killed Nancy. I had never been to that floor, though I spent many years at the Chelsea. There is definitely something there. It was so scary. And that's true. A lot of people, so many reports, I didn't have time to, or a place to put them, but Sid and Nancy, that room is just fucked. There's so much arguing and bickering and
I mean, it makes sense because he did kill her, so I guess in the afterlife, I sure hope she's beating the shit out of him or something. But, yeah, a lot of bad energy coming from that room. Lastly, creeps, we have celebrity photographer Lisa Ackerman, who lived at the Chelsea between 2000 and 2013. This is cute. Lisa's ghost story is abnormal because she knew her ghost personally. Quote, "The only ghost I can say I encountered was my dog, Maggie. After she died in 2012, I'd feel something jump up on my bed and plop down at my feet. When I'd look, I didn't see anything. This would happen from time to time until I moved away." I love that. That's how we should view animals, you witless, anal fisher, animal porn ghost guy.
I had many similar feelings, too. I don't know if it was muscle memory, but when I had to get rid of my, not get rid of, but when I had to euthanize my cat, Rena, who was the sweetest thing ever, I don't know. Like, I would be in bed, and I would just feel her jump on the bed, and I don't know if that's just muscle memory or if that's really them comforting us. I hope that it's really them. It felt real. Still feels real to this day.
That's something I never got over. You know, I could enthrall.
I'm having a hard day. Words are hard today.
I could enthrall the Creep Nation for hours with these stories, but there's so fucking many. So I'm going to stop here. But that's kind of the point. The haunted tales of the Chelsea Hotel are endless and span generations and decades and centuries. Not to get all R.L. Stine on you, but when discussing residents of this landmark hotel, they're mostly ghostly. I used to feel things when I stayed at the Plaza all the time in New York City, but man, I wish I knew then what I know now. I wish I could have stayed at the Chelsea before it closed in 2011. Although, I reckon I could always sneak onto the property and risk arrest. It's not like Mary or Nadia or Hipster Larry have gone anywhere. You know what? Go fund me some bail money, creeps. As I hit last call on this creepisode, I'll leave you with a quote from a particular legend named Janis Joplin. Quote is, "A lot of funky things happen in the Chelsea."
Well, you said it, sis.
The following is a paid advertisement.
There comes a point in everyone's life when they are faced with the ultimate desire, the ultimate dream. That is, of course, to own a haunted hotel. Folks, we've all been there. It's a part of life, a part of growing up. No different than puberty, or a first kiss, or getting arrested for urinating on a statue of the Frisch's big boy mascot. Point is, it is a vision we've all had. Owning a haunted hotel. But, reality sets in. One day you'll wake up and realize you are not a silver-haired, mutton-chop white man with resting bitch face in a black-and-white photo from 1830. Life gets in the way, folks. And with the pressure of 2.5 kids, a dog, and a white picket fence, the basic human need to own a haunted hotel falls by the wayside. Always has. Always will. Not anymore. Not until now. Here at the Scariot Hotel chain, we can make the ghostly goals of your youth a reality. With over 1,500 properties and growing, you too can be the proprietor of your very own Scariot Hotel. When you join the Scariot family, you'll be mentored in the following areas: how to locate dilapidated properties in rundown sections of your target city for mere pennies on the dollar. You'll learn how to ensure people have, and will, die at your very own Scariot Hotel through traumatic means such as murder, suicide, or overdosing on illicit drugs to ensure their full-time residency in the netherworld. You'll also learn how to secure faulty wiring, malfunctioning appliances, and spooky-looking gothic antique fixtures. And finally, you will learn how to spread the word of your haunted hotel through podcasts, blogs, social media, and secondhand accounts that grow by the day. As a member of the Scariot Hotel family, you will be eligible for lawsuit protection, police payoffs to look the other way, and a creative team to help you rebrand. Should too many people discover that your hotel is haunted, or that perhaps a serial killer once lived there. So, what are you waiting for? The time to act is now. Leave the doldrums of the 9-to-5 lifestyle behind. Become as pale as moonlight. Develop an eerie demeanor. And open your Scariot Hotel today. Folks, all of this is for the low, low price of you and your children's souls. You can start living your dream tomorrow. Call 1-666-666-6666 or go to www.scariothotel/death.com for your free information packet. Do so now and receive a free creaky stairwell. No purchase necessary. Again, that's 1-666-666-6666 or www.scariothotel/death.com. And folks, remember, at the Scariot Hotel, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
Well, there you have it, creeps. Thank you again once more for joining me on a creepity, creepity, creep edition of the Creepy Crawl podcast. I just want you to know, you individually are all my homies. You know what? If you need to go into the ocean that is called the world, make sure when going on that ocean, you choose the right ship. And the right ship is friendship. And you have chosen wisely with your water vessel, creeps, because you are my friends. As always, I want to thank again my lovely patrons and patronesses. You can join these people, or your ghost can. Patreon.com/creepycrawl. You can also go to Venmo for a direct hit. That is at Jonathan-Allen-154. And do be sure to follow me on the Bluebird at writer John Allen, no H, boy band style, for random bullshit, lots of puns, and the photos that make these stories come together. So today's imaginary outro music is something I had not prepared for, so I am going to quickly random Spotify shuffle. And I hit it too hard. It's spinning like that wheel on The Price is Right. Ah, here we are. Today's imaginary outro music is Cherish by Kool & the Gang. Man, I'll tell you, creeps, that jam takes me back to the 80s. I, of course, was probably too young to be thinking about cherishing girls, but nonetheless, I did. And that jam holds a place. It warms the cockles of my heart. If you have an idea for an episode, please hit me up on that Twitter. And until next time, creeps, check out the hotel reviews before you book. Maybe consider an Airbnb. Don't ever stay in a death suite. And until next time, Creepy Crawl on.